Model Test 4.
Section A. Mini Lecture.
In this section, you will hear a mini lecture. You will hear the mini lecture once only. While listening to the mini lecture, please complete the gap-filling task with no more than 3 words for each gap. Make sure the word or words you fill in is or are both grammatically and semantically acceptable. You may use the blank sheet for note-taking. You have 30 seconds to preview the gap-filling task. Now, listen to the mini-lecture. When it is over, you will be given 3 minutes to check your work.
Good morning. Today's lecture on communicating with strangers is the first of the series of lectures under the general topic Intercultural Communication. Every day, we communicate the way we do because we are raised in a particular culture and learn its language, rules, and norms. Different cultures and subcultures may have different rules and norms. Therefore, understanding the other's culture facilitates cross-cultural communication. All communication occurs between people who have varying degrees of familiarity with each other. The key factor in understanding intercultural communication is the concept of the stranger and the definition of strangeness. First, strangeness and familiarity make up a continuum. We use the term stranger to refer to those people at the most unfamiliar end of the continuum. Thus, anyone could be considered a stranger given a sufficiently foreign context. A stranger has limited knowledge of their new environment, of its norms and values. And in turn, the locals have little knowledge of the stranger, of his or her beliefs, interests, and habits. Generally speaking, communication with another involves predicting or anticipating their responses. When communicating with someone familiar, we are usually confident in our anticipation and may not even notice that we are making such predictions. In contrast, when we communicate with strangers, we are more aware of the range of their possible responses and of the uncertainty of our predictions. But where do our predictions come from? Communicative predictions are based on data from 3 levels. First is the cultural level. This level involves information about the other's culture, its dominant values and norms. This is often the only level of information available when communicating with a stranger. Even so, a better understanding of the stranger's culture yields better predictions. The second level of information is sociocultural. This includes data about the other's group membership or the groups to which they seek to belong. This type of information is the predominant data used in intracultural communication. Finally, there is psychocultural data. This is information about the individual's characteristics and is the sort of data most relevant to communication with friends. Then, how do we process the prediction data when we communicate with strangers? The answer is that we understand such data by the process of social cognition. Social cognition is a dialectical process which involves both grouping particulars into categories based on their similarities and of distinguishing individuals from their categories based on their differences. Communication with strangers often relies too heavily on categorization or stereotyping. Such stereotypes may be inaccurate or may not apply to the present individual. To improve communication with strangers, we must pay attention to their unique, individual features. Effective communication with strangers requires an increased awareness of our communication behaviors. First, we tend to categorize things automatically, and so we are less aware of doing it. It takes more of our conscious awareness to differentiate particular individuals from their stereotypical categories. Second, much of our daily communication follows familiar scripts, and so we are not consciously aware of that communication behavior. We cannot rely on such familiar scripts and norms when communicating with a stranger. Our communication will be improved if we recognize that familiar scripts do not apply and seek to modify our communication behaviors accordingly. Finally, we need to talk about some ways to reduce people's uncertainty and anxiety during their communication with strangers. Generally, in communication, we seek to reduce uncertainty. Communication with strangers involves relatively greater degrees of uncertainty due to the difficulty in predicting a stranger's responses. We experience uncertainty with regard to the stranger's attitudes, feelings, and beliefs. We are also uncertain of how to explain the stranger's behavior. Motivation to reduce this uncertainty is more acute when we expect to have further interactions with the stranger or when they are a potential source of benefit. We may reduce our uncertainty and increase the accuracy of our predictions by gaining more information about the stranger. There are three basic strategies for gathering such information. One may passively observe the stranger. One may actively seek out information from other friends of the stranger or from books. Finally, one may seek information directly from the stranger by interacting with them and asking questions. Also, offering information about oneself often prompts reciprocal offerings of information from another. The increased uncertainty in interactions with strangers is accompanied by higher levels of anxiety as we anticipate a wider array of possible negative outcomes. We may worry about damage to our self-esteem from feeling confused and out of control. We may fear the possibility of being incompetent or being exploited. We may worry about being perceived negatively by the stranger, and we may worry that interacting with a stranger will bring disapproval from members of our own group. Generally, these anxieties can be reduced by paying more conscious attention to the communication process and by gathering more information on the stranger. Generally, individuals tend to explain their own behavior by reference to the situation. Observers tend to attribute an individual's behavior to elements of that individual's character. When interacting with strangers, we are especially likely to attribute their behavior to their character and then to view their character as typical of their culture or race, etc. That is, we are especially likely to interpret a stranger's behavior in light of our stereotypes about what those kind of people are like. As a result, consciously focusing on the communication process itself is an effective solution so as to gather more information about the stranger and hence to lower the level of anxiety. Finally, let's review the basic concepts covered in today's lecture. First, we talked about the concept of the stranger and definition of strangeness. Communicating with strangers involves uncertain predictions of their responses. Second, we discussed where communicative predictions come from and how they are processed during communication. And the last concerns our suggestions on some strategies to reduce people's uncertainty and anxiety during their communication with strangers.
Now, you have 3 minutes to check your work. This is the end of Section A mini lecture.
Section B, interview.
In this section, you will hear one interview. The interview will be divided into two parts. At the end of each part, 5 questions will be asked about what was said. Both the interview and the questions will be spoken once only. After each question, there will be a 10-second pause. During the pause, you should read the 4 choices of A, B, C, and D, and mark the best answer to each question. You have 30 seconds to preview the questions. Now, listen to part 1 of the interview.
Good morning, everyone. Today, we are very glad to have Professor Michael Stevenson, an official from the British Council. He is going to talk with us about educational system in the tertiary level in UK. Well, Professor?
Hello, nice to meet you all.
Professor Stevenson, we all know that British universities accept students from all over the world. What precautions should overseas students take while studying there?
Well, they should first adapt themselves to the educational environment in Britain. Students from Asian countries, especially, are used to passive learning in their own countries, but here we want active learning.
What is the main difference between them?
By active learning, I mean students should take an active role in professors' lectures by imposing and answering questions. They need also to be talkative in discussion sessions and seminars. Of course, their homework should be based a lot on their research into reference material. By comparison, students from Asian countries are not indulgent enough during class time. They are good listeners, though. Professors do not only want them to listen and remember, but participate and contribute too.
I see. This may be due to their study habit in their own countries. Besides, Asian people are usually very reserved.
So this may be a big obstacle to their study in British universities. It is often difficult for them to get good marks in courses, let alone achieve awards smoothly.
Awards? What awards?
Well, British universities offer their students awards at various degrees and diplomas for their satisfactory completion of coursework and examination.
That means they have successfully completed their university education?
Yes. The 2 best-known examples are the BA, or Bachelor of Arts, and the BSc, or Bachelor of Science, at undergraduate level. These are sometimes also called first degree.
Why are they called first degree?
Well, because they are the first award that a student is likely to be given by the university. There are over 5,000 degree subjects and combinations of subjects offered at universities throughout Britain. Bachelor-level degrees are normally given at the end of 3 or 4 years' coursework. Some universities offer 4-year courses, especially for students from overseas. The 4 years are made up of 1 preparatory year plus 3 years of degree courses.
So overseas students needn't worry about their low English proficiency. They can always make up for it during the preparatory year.
Exactly. Besides English, they are also given other academic courses to help them lay a solid foundation for further study.
Is it the same for all kinds of degrees?
No. Courses leading to degrees in medicine, dentistry and architecture can take from 3 to 7 years. Diplomas are included in this category because they too meet the criteria I have laid down before. That is to say, they are also awarded on the satisfactory completion of coursework and examination. Diploma courses normally only last for 1 year.
This is the end of part 1 of the interview. Questions 1 to 5 are based on what you have just heard.
Question 1. Which one is not the suggestion for Asian students, according to the professor?
Question 2. What is the main topic of this interview?
Question 3. Why are BA or Bachelor of Arts and BSc or Bachelor of Science called first degree?
Question 4. Which can help overseas students improve their English proficiency?
Question 5. How many years do diploma courses normally last for?
Now, listen to part 2 of the interview.
They are, too, usually more narrowly specialized and more professionally oriented. Thus, they are more often given to people who are training to be teachers or social workers and who already have a bachelor-level degree.
Then what do students study after acquiring their first degree?
After that, they are those degrees which a university gives for the successful completion of a piece of research. The MA, or Master of Arts, the MSc, or Master of Science, and the MBA, or Master of Business Administration, are the ones most frequently awarded here at postgraduate level. At one time, these degrees were awarded only for the completion of research work, but over the past 20 years or so, a large number of additional master degrees have been introduced, which combine a quite small piece of research with a substantial amount of coursework on which the student is examined.
Then there is doctor degree, right?
Yes. It is called PhD, or Doctor of Philosophy, which is the most prestigious research degree. It is awarded for a piece of research which shows great depth and considerable originality. It is expected to make a significant contribution to our knowledge of and understanding of a problem. It usually involves at least 4 years full-time research.
I've also heard of honorary degrees. Are they master degree or doctor degree?
Well, this is a totally different matter. These are, for example, the D.Litt, or Doctor of Letters, Doctor Literarum, if you want it in the original Latin, the D.Sc., or Doctor of Science, and the L.L.D., or Doctor of Laws. These awards may be, in fact, often are, awarded for people who have never been to university at all. They are very often, in fact, given to people who have distinguished themselves in some field of non-academic activity outside. Thus, the university may wish to honour a famous writer by giving him or her a D.Litt, or a famous politician by giving him or her an L.L.D.
Professor Stevenson, you have provided us with a detailed introduction to university education in Britain. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
This is the end of part 2 of the interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on what you have just heard. Question 6. Which is not the target group of diploma courses?
Question 7. What do students study after acquiring their first degree?
Question 8. Which statement about PhD is false, according to the interview?
Question 9. Which degree will not be awarded to students at British universities?
Question 10. Which one is not honorary degree?